Welcome back, SI Boxing Podcast. On this episode, got a great conversation with Gareth A. Davies, British boxing journalist with The Telegraph, Talk Sport, many other outlets. We discuss Canelo Alvarez's lopsided win over Avdi Yildirim. Sanctioning bodies, what can they do to prevent the likes of Yildirim from being put in the mandatory positions? We look ahead to Canelo against Billy Joe Saunders. That fight scheduled for May 8th. And Tyson Fury against Anthony Joshua. Are we anticipating any problems with that heavyweight unification class as we kind of anxiously await that fight being finalized? A little bit later on, Clarissa Shields, the three-division world champion. She is going to try to become the undisputed junior middleweight champion to become the first male or female to become undisputed in two weight classes in the four-belt era. I talked to Clarissa about that fight. I talked to her about her first appearance on pay-per-view, what she's looking for it there, and why she was driven to it, and the future of Clarissa Shields and Katie Taylor, which I think would be a fight that would determine the greatest woman of all time. As always, best way to support this podcast, head over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to the show.
Ever been ringside and got blood on you?
Oh, all the time.
This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
Anthony Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher. Watch this.
Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion.
Hosted by SI's Chris Mannix.
No, it's really embarrassing.
That was my moment.
Now with interviews, analysis, and everything going on in the world of boxing.
When you have talent, you are given another chance.
Here's Chris Mannix.
All right, Gareth A. Davies is here, boxing journalist over at The Telegraph, William Hill at The Zone, Talk Sport, many other places, plies his trade across the globe. Glad to have him back on the podcast. What's up, Gareth?
Well, unlike you, who's got the privilege of being at all these events and calling them at the moment and actually mixing with people, we're kind of still in deep lockdown here, but you know, hopefully we'll come out of it. There's plenty of events going on, which is nice. We've had a couple of upsets here. Boxing started in mid-February. We had a six-week hiatus. But my word, my friend, it's great to be back. And, you know, we're almost on the anniversary of COVID happening and the world locking down. So it's been a weird year for all of us, hasn't it? But, I mean, yeah. I've had my Pfizer jab, my first jab, because I'm in the over 50s. So, one has to look at it at the moment and say, you can't complain. We're very fortunate. We do something we love, and what we love is happening at the moment. And there's a lot of it happening, hence us being here talking now, you know?
Yeah, it's good to have people back at events, even when they're socially distanced like they were last weekend in Miami, 80,000 plus seat stadium with 15,000 fans in there. Look, there's a difference. I mean, 2 weeks earlier, you know, we called at DAZN, we called the Jojo Diaz Shavkat Rakhimov fight behind closed doors. That was eerie. And we've done a few of those. And you go to, you know, Dolphin Stadium, Hard Rock Live down there. And, you know, in addition to the fireworks show and the, you know, the ring walk and all the cool things that went into it, having fans mattered. It created an atmosphere that you missed. You forget. It's like they say with everything, you don't know what you have until it's gone. Well, you know, we missed having an atmosphere at these events. So good to have people back in the venue. That's where I want to begin with you, Gareth. The Canelo Avdi Yildirim fight. What Avdi Yildirim did in that fight was embarrassing. Like, he didn't even try. Like, didn't, you know, biggest opportunity of your life. You will never, ever get an opportunity like this again. And you go out and sort of sleepwalk through three rounds and quit on your stool. I mean, that's unrecoverable in the boxing world. I know it's easy for us journalists on the side to say, go out there and let your hands go against the best fighter in the world. But otherwise, what the hell are you doing in the ring? Like, you're there. You're the mandatory challenger. You have this opportunity. At least try to take advantage of it. I thought he was brutal. I thought Canelo was Canelo. I thought he looked sharp. He had a good game plan. He went to the body. He threw a knockdown punch, a 1-2 straight down the middle that I'd never seen him do before. So that was a new, you know, wrinkle to Canelo's game. Give me your thoughts on Canelo's performance and I guess, what you thought of Yildirim.
Well, I'll start with Canelo, and I think he really is approaching the prime of his life now and the prime of his career, and you can see it in the confidence to be able to speak more English. I mean, I often speak to him in Spanish anyway. I'm a Spanish speaker, so and try and give him confidence to speak English. I saw him speaking a lot more English, and that Matchroom probably helps that, and being with DAZN globally probably helps that, because that's an element to him. Remember when we were all covering Manny Pacquiao? When he improved his English, he became more charming, more endearing to the American media, and he became the darling of the media as a result. And I think Canelo can go on that route for a start, and I think that's beginning. And that's the confidence of him as a man. But he's stepping, you know, you've covered sports for a long time, as I have, and everyone has their purple periods when there's a light that glows on them, like a halo around them, you know? I'm not going to sing Beyonce here, but but you never know, you know? You can see in him, there's a special light around him at the moment. The camp is so rich, with Ryan Garcia in the background, Andy Garcia losing weight, the Reynosos getting the respect and the accolades that they deserve in the way that they are punctilious, meticulous in the way they train fighters. Oscar Valdez as well in that group. And look how brilliant he's been just recently. From the Canelo perspective, everything was perfect about him. I mean, the ring walk was a bit long for me the other night. I think it was 7 minutes or something, wasn't it? We saw it in the... I mean, I worked with you that night in the Callum Smith fight. We saw a different Canelo that night. The offensive, bullish fighter that we're used to, but with defensive nous bolted on now. To hit and not be hit is part of his objective now. And that's a sign of maturity. So everything from his perspective was perfect. Probably like you, I called it as a 3-5 round fight, because there's levels in this game. And we knew that this is a guy in Avni Yildirim who'd been stopped by Chris Eubank Jr., who was very aggressive with him on the night. But it was like... Avni Yildirim, it was almost like he'd been drugged. He obviously wasn't drugged, but it's like someone had given him a sedative. Do you know what I mean? There was no fight in him. But I wonder, talking about Canelo in that way, whether he'd felt the aura of Canelo during the week, and he was actually beaten before he stepped in there. And that's the only way that I can plausibly give him the out, rather than harangue what he actually did in there. You know, I could argue that you could have thrown more punches, you'd have been knocked out in 30 seconds, as I would have been, but you could have thrown, a journeyman, let's say, could have thrown more punches and put on a better performance than Avni Yildirim. It was staggeringly mystifying, because that's all he did. I think I saw him land one straight right, and a couple of fences to the body. And other than that, he was a punch bag for Canelo. I'm not saying I wasn't delighted that Canelo won, because I want to see him in against Billy Joe Saunders, and I know we'll come on to that, but it was just weird. And Avni let the event down in many ways, because every event with Canelo is so big. I know we're working on these things, so we tend to see them as bigger than they are to the whole world. But in our niche area, he's a big deal every time he steps up now. DAZN promote him wonderfully. Eddie Hearn did a great job with him, wearing his pajamas during the week. You know, white pajamas on fight night, Dolce & Gabbana black pajamas on the Friday. You know,
And I'm not sure, Gareth, I'm not sure which was a weirder look, being honest with you. Like,
definitely the black Dolce & Gabbana, because Eddie gives me stick about my hair is 80s like George Michael. You know, he gives me stick about wearing Vans in my 50s and, you know, my shirts and my waistcoat. But, I mean, to be honest, if any promoter's going to pull it off, it's Eddie Hearn. I mean, God forbid Bob Arum now turns up in a pair of pajamas at the next event. But who knows? But, you know, it was just such a shame that Yildirim wasn't the bull that he normally is in the ring, the stud that he can be. You know, because you'd have... I thought he'd go out on his sword after three or five rounds, and we, you know, that Canelo would do what he did against Callum Smith and just show how clever he is. But it was a real disappointment, genuinely a real disappointment. And when you're getting up to cover it at 4 a.m. here and writing about it, it was a shame. It was a shame. But he is an event now in himself, isn't he, Canelo? I mean, you were around him all week. You interviewed him. He's fascinating now, isn't he? Because he's opened up a little bit more, you know?
Well, I mean, he has certainly done that. And he just oozes confidence in a way I haven't seen really since Floyd Mayweather. I mean, there's just a unflinching belief that nobody can touch him, that he's the best fighter in the world, whether it's against Callum Smith or against Avni Yildirim. That's a transition we're seeing Canelo over the last 2 to 3 years, really since the second Golovkin fight. I feel like there's been that metamorphosis in Canelo Alvarez that understands just how good he is.
Yeah, and also, Chris, he's transcending the sport at the moment. This is his 2 years now where he will become a Tiger Woods. He'll become a Lionel Messi. You know, he'll become... You know, like the great basketball players that you cover, the Michael Jordans of this world, that he is definitely on that trajectory now. And it's brilliant to be around it.
Oh, well, it goes by one name. There's only a handful of athletes ever that go by one name. And that's certainly, you know, a feather in his cap. One thing I want to touch on is I don't want to get into any more of that. I hope Avni Yildirim goes away and we never hear from him again.
Well, that's a bit mean.
But... I mean, all right, on high level boxing. I don't want to hear from him again. I'm sure we will hear from him again because it'll be former world title challenger. We know, you know, that label can get you a couple of decent fights.
You've got to be careful in the period of cancel culture saying like something like that about someone because people do go at the moment, you know.
Yeah, there are a lot of fighters, you know, like, got to show up, got to at least try to win. That's just my take on it. We had Mauricio Sulaiman, who is the president of the WBC. He was on with DAZN's Achim Barak earlier this week, and he kind of suggested there now needs to be changes with the mandatory challengers. My first reaction there, Gareth, was like, okay, you come to this epiphany after Yildirim stinks out the joint. Anybody that knew boxing, and Mauricio Sulaiman should know boxing, knew that Yildirim had no business being the mandatory challenger. His last fight was 2 years ago, and he lost. Yeah. And granted, there was a touch of controversy as part of it with the Anthony Durrell fight. But not only did he lose, but he's been idle since then. I know there were some issues. Obviously, COVID taking over last year. There was a Benavidez fight that fell apart, but he didn't fight. So you put a very average fighter to begin with, who in his most high-profile fights has been knocked out by Chris Eubank and has lost Anthony Durrell, has won low-level fights in between. Marco Antonio Parabon was probably the biggest name of the guys that he beat. You put him as your mandatory challenger, and you can't tell me that there weren't qualified fighters available for that position. I'll give you one, Gareth. Like, David Lemieux has problems with activity, but David Lemieux fought two more times between when Yildirim last fought in 2019. Like, David Lemieux, a former champion at 160 pounds, would have been a more qualified candidate. So I agree with Mauricio Sulaiman that these mandatory challengers and how they're chosen and who is put in these positions needs to be re-envisioned. But don't sit there and tell me that now, after the fighter you put in that position stunk out the joint, because you should have known. Everybody should have known.
Absolutely.
It's so completely... it's just false. It's shameless to say something.
Well,
you
know yourself, when you've covered boxing a long time, that because there's no world governing body, there's a lawlessness to boxing. It's like the Wild West at times, isn't it? You know, that. I mean, in the same way, you can look at the heavyweight division with the WBC. Look at Dillian White waiting nearly 3 years to get a fight with Deontay Wilder he never got, you know? I mean, yeah. So there, you've got one side of it where a mandatory challenger really doesn't deserve to be there. And you've got another side of it where a guy who's ranked number one really does, or, you know, Dillian's been mandatory for, was mandatory for a long time, wants to stay active and ends up losing to Povetkin in the end for the interim title last August, and has the courage to step up as he's going to do. And I'm going out to Gibraltar, the rumble on the rock, you know, so there's so many kind of inadequacies about the whole process of it. We know, and the real fight fans know, who should be fighting who and what fight should be made. So, you know, it was a stinker. It was a stinker in many ways. It was indefensible. Can I say that? It was indefensible, really, that he was given that role. Like you say, I was just getting excited at the thought of David Lemieux going in and giving his all against a Canelo. That would have been so much better. You need some risk and reward. There was no risk, no reward. You know, you just knew it was the thinnest of banana skins ever, wasn't it? If it was.
David Lemieux at least banged with Gennady Golovkin before getting knocked out. David Lemieux has power in that big left hand of his. Like, he can crack. I would have much preferred to see David Lemieux. Anyway.
But there's another thing as well, Chris. It made sense, now you say it, because you had the Billy Joe Saunders performance against David Lemieux to compare with as well. And that's this was a semi-final before the final, wasn't it, in a way? So, you know, if Canelo had gone in there and had war with him for five rounds, it would have given us a benchmark to talk about what Billy Joe did with David Lemieux, and a natural precursor to building up the fight. So, nice matchmaking, Mr. Mannix.
Hey, well, I just want to go with the guy that's earned the opportunity. And Lemieux, who has had inactivity problems of his own, as we mentioned, has been more active than Yildirim and was certainly more deserving based on past performances than Yildirim. Anyway, the end of the fight, you get the announcement that we all knew was coming. Billy Joe Saunders against Canelo, 168-pound unification fight. That'll take place in May, location to be determined. You know, I thought around in December, when the Callum Smith fight was approaching, I believe Callum Smith was number one at 168. I thought he was the most proven guy at super middleweight. You know, the title, Ring Magazine, whatever accolade you want to give him, I thought he was the best. But there certainly are, I think, a lot more people that believe Billy Joe Saunders is a tougher test for Canelo than Callum Smith, whether it's Oscar De La Hoya, who talked about that this week. You've had John Ryder, who, of course, associated with Billy Joe with Matchroom. Other fighters I've read say similar things. Do you believe that Billy Joe Saunders will be a tougher test for Canelo than Callum Smith
was? I think stylistically, yes. And I think Billy Joe Saunders, when and if he faces Callum Smith, I think he'll beat him as well, you know, because I think his skill set, I think it's a weird fight, and a fight with a lot of feeling out. And I'm talking about Callum Smith and Billy Joe Saunders now. But, you know, I've known Billy Joe Saunders a long time, since he was an Olympian back in Beijing in 2008 when he was 18. He's probably the best boxer pound for pound in the UK in terms of skill set. Maybe Josh Taylor as well fits into that mold. Maybe Tyson Fury. But I think the skill, if Saunders is really on his game, he could be very tricky for Canelo. But I think the Canelo we're seeing at the moment will be very patient with him. So I do see Canelo as the favorite. The big thing for us over here is, can this guy, Billy Joe Saunders, who has always, you know, he was brilliant against Andy Lee. He worked his way through a very aggressive, tenacious Chris Eubank Jr., what is it, maybe 6-7 years ago now. Might be 5 or 6. But he's always found a way, because he's got not just great footwork and timing and skill set and comfort in the office, in the square circle, but he moves brilliantly from the waist. He changes levels so well. He's southpaw. The big problem for Billy, I think, in this fight is, And obviously he's out in camp in Spain at the moment working with Jimmy Tibbs, with Mark Tibbs, the son of the very renowned trainer Jimmy Tibbs, who even sparred with Muhammad Ali years ago and is very loved and revered in our world over here. Billy Joe Saunders needs a strategy and a game plan against Canelo. He needs A, B, C, D plans. He's got to get in. He's got to command the space between them. And he's got to land combinations and get out. Because I don't think he's going to knock Canelo out. He's so durable. He's got a brilliant chin. His punch volume is enormous. I'm fascinated in the duel when they exchange. And I think given... I don't want to say that Canelo's going to get a decision if it goes to points, but he is likely to. So, because he's very eye-catching in everything he does. He's worked out being busy in the first 30 and last 30 seconds of a round. The Reynosos are working on all the tricks for him. So I think Billy Joe Saunders can beat Canelo, but he's got to throw combinations and get away again. He's got to engage enough to win rounds. And he's got to be up in rounds when they get to round six or seven. He's got to be a couple of rounds ahead. I want your take on it as well, because I'm fascinated how you see it. But I think Billy Joe Saunders, when he's sharp, he's clearly up for this, as you saw with his Instagram post straight away with his apron and his swinging fake dildo hanging off his apron. Did you see that?
I did not.
Oh,
see
it's,
that,
you've no. got to go back on his Instagram. You've got to see his.
Let me write that down. Let me go see that.
Go see
put
it.
Put that on a list of
it.
Things to do.
A fake penis hanging off his apron. It was very funny. But Saunders is very skillful. He really is. I don't know how you see the fight, whether you think it's a proper test for Canelo.
I think it's probably going to be his toughest test since Golovkin, a tougher test than even Daniel Jacobs, who was pretty good against Canelo at times. I think Saunders, his boxing skills are among the best Canelo has ever faced. And Canelo, he's faced some good boxers, most of them earlier in his career when he's going up against Arislandi Lara and, of course, Floyd Mayweather. Since then, he's fought Golovkin, more power puncher, Cotto, kind of back end of his career at that time. So he hasn't faced someone with those types of skills. And I think Saunders, we know he's going to be up for it. He's always up for big fights. He's often down for the lesser ones, but we know we're going to get the best of Billy Joe Saunders like we did against Chris Eubank and like we did against David Lemieux. So I think the best of Billy Joe Saunders certainly has the ability over the course of 12 rounds to cause Canelo problems. I don't know if he's going to be active enough to steal rounds. There are two things that have quasi worked against Canelo in recent years. There was Golovkin's power jab. Golovkin has one of the stiffest, strongest jabs in all of boxing. And in that second fight, Canelo won, and he won, I thought, deservedly. But he took a lot of power jabs from Golovkin, just kept pumping it and pumping it and pumping it and keeping Canelo at bay a little bit. Then there was the Kovalev style. Kovalev, I don't think, was winning the fight when it was knocked out, but he was throwing hundreds of jabs. He was just flicking it out there over and over and over again. I think Saunders has an effective jab, but can he do it with the consistency, with the regularity that we saw Kovalev do? And can he do it with more accuracy? Because sitting ringside for the Kovalev fight, it was very clear that Canelo, whose defense is excellent, was either gobbling up those punches or avoiding them with his head movement. So it's a long way of saying, Gareth, that I think he can cause problems, but just like with Kovalev and just like with Golovkin, I just feel like Canelo is eventually going to catch up with you. And Callum Smith made this point, and I don't know what you think about it. Callum Smith just said, I don't know that if Billy Joe Saunders has the power to get Canelo's respect. I'm paraphrasing a little bit there, but basically talking about his power. Kovalev, at least theoretically, had the power that Canelo had to be wary of. If Canelo's not afraid of your power, he's going to keep walking you down and walking you down absorbing some of your jabs, and then hammering you with big head and body
shots.
Like
you say, that's the massive thing in this fight. He's got to either hurt Canelo at some point or totally get his respect. Totally get his respect so that Canelo isn't walking through firepower or walking through punches, because he will. You mentioned Erez Lendi Lara there. I think that's a really good comparison because he's got a similar, even though it's a Cuban style, Billy, in his words, has the gypsy style, which is been doing it since he was 5 years old, completely comfortable, as I say, in the office. But Lara is a very similar type of opponent. Lara's southpaw as well, wasn't he? And he gave Canelo issues. But is that 6 years ago? I was at the fight.
Longer. I think it was seven.
Yeah, I think we were probably both at the fight. Yeah. We were probably both at that fight. I remember I was. I'm sure you were. It was a Vegas fight, wasn't it? You know? And that's the guy I've been looking at. But has Canelo really changed since then? I think he has. So that's the kind of... He's got to be tricky with him. But like you say, the key thing is he's got to land, and he's got to land effectively, and he's got to keep Canelo off him, you know? So, but it's fascinating because no one's undone Billy Joe Saunders. No one's beaten him. He's an undefeated, what is he, 30-0 or so, 28 or 30-0, I think. So no one's beaten him. And when you get a fighter who's undefeated, who has that confidence coming into a fight like this, and also Billy has been waiting for the right moment for this fight. He obviously was due to fight Canelo last, I think, May, wasn't it? It was going to be the May fight, but obviously that wasn't happening during COVID. He was due to fight him around August time, wasn't he? And then decided, no, I don't want the opportunity because I don't want to do it on 19 days notice. I want a full camp. And I respect him for that. He doesn't care about the money. Obviously, he's going to be paid handsomely for the feat. But his preparation is second to none at the moment. So we're going to get a prime Billy Joe Saunders against a prime Canelo, an undefeated fighter who has the opportunity to record a victory over the number one pound-for-pound fighter in the world. That's huge. So he can make history. And you may not know this, but the traveler race, boxing is their national sport. So he's got enormous support in that way. And he genuinely can create a legacy with this one victory. It can go down as arguably one of the greatest British victories of all time. So all of that fire that he'll have under him makes him a great opponent for Canelo at this time, I believe. I'm really excited about the fight. I'm really looking forward to getting into Billy's camp house 10 days before and being around him and being around it all. It's going to be tremendous. He's benefited from years of working with people like Ben Davison, who's only in his 20s, but I think he's one of the great trainers in the world. Very astute. Look what he did with Tyson Fury, bringing him back from the brink, helping him lose 10 stone, taking him into that first Deontay Wilder fight. So he's an advisor to Billy Joe. They're close friends, as well as Mark Tibbs training Billy Joe. So yeah, I'm really, really excited about this contest. Really excited.
And we know he's going to talk.
Oh yeah.
A lot.
Oh yeah.
Over the next couple of months. Yeah. Though I got to say, Gareth, I don't know if that works on Canelo. I mean, nobody talked more than Gennady Golovkin and Abel Sanchez before that second fight, whether it was about Canelo running in the first fight or effectively calling him like the Barry Bonds of boxing with all the drugs that, you know, they alleged or purported that he had probably been taking at some point in his career. And Canelo just used that as fuel and then took it to Golovkin in ways that no fighter had taken it to Golovkin before. So I don't know the trash talk works.
No, I agree with you. I don't know... But like he's very similar character to Tyson Fury. He'll do the unexpected. Like, if you want to get stuck into Canelo, push him at the weigh-in. Slap his face. Do something unusual. And if Billy wants to do something unusual, he'll do it. And if enough travelers, enough of Billy's supporters can go over for the event, I hope they do. It'll make it a great occasion. Rather than it be another home fight for Canelo in America, home fights. So I think Canelo doesn't engage in that kind of thing, but I think it's possible. It's possible to get into anybody's head. But we won't know till they really come face to face. And it's a shame that because of COVID regulations and having to quarantine and all those things, they couldn't get Billy over there. I'd love to have seen you interviewing the pair of them in the ring afterwards. You know, Billy would have come up with something, and he didn't have the opportunity to leave Canelo with something to go into camp to think about. But I can't wait to see those two guys face to face.
Yeah, neither can I. So let's start with where this fight stands, Gareth. I saw Frank Warren say something this week that we're getting closer. Eddie Hearn has told the both of us something similar. Bob Arum has expressed optimism that this fight will be made. On the flip side of it, you've got Tyson Fury, with whatever information he has, taking to social media and suggesting maybe it's not that close to being finished. Anthony Joshua has said, enough of this Twitter. Let's just make the fight happen. Where do you think we are with these negotiations?
I think we're very close. I think we're within a fortnight of that contract being signed. Well, they've got the contract for the two-fight deal, 50-50, 60-40 for the winner-loser, is agreed. But I think, you know, the teams of lawyers are going over the fine print at the moment. I think Anthony Joshua was cryptically saying all of last week and on Sunday, last Sunday, in a live stream with one of his sponsors, that he sounded optimistic that it was getting closer and closer. I think that interview that Tyson Fury did with Brett Okamoto on ESPN, where he seemed to pour water on the fire, was just him expressing frustration. Outside the interview that I did with Tyson at the time, privately he told me that he hoped that deal would be done a few days ago. He'd given it till the end of February, only because he didn't get a December fight. And he's already now, we've just passed the anniversary of a year since he fought Deontay Wilder on that memorable night in Las Vegas when he took the WBC crown. And I think it was just frustration at the thought that if this fight wasn't going to be signed and sealed by the end of March or the end of April, that the whole time he's losing time because he's 18 months out, 20 months out. If he gets the fight in June or July, he's been out 18 months. Activity is one of the key discussions in boxing at the moment. We're seeing champions struggle because so many of the top 30, 40 fighters in the world have all been pretty much inactive for a year because of COVID and the restrictions. So I think it was just pure frustration. And Tyson, as I know privately, I text with him all the time. I'm chasing him up on things. I think he's staying in shape. He's in the gym. You've seen in the interview just there that he's in fantastic shape. Mentally, he's good. He's in the gym twice a day. And he's so skillful that he's one of the few fighters in the world that can go into a heavyweight undisputed fight, having been out for 18 months, if they fight, say, in the Middle East in June or July, as we expect. So, and I think he has a skill set beyond Anthony Joshua. It's what Joshua is going to bring to Tyson Fury that I'm interested in this fight. Has he developed? Has he developed a way of boxing his way through probably the most difficult, awkward opponent and the most important fight he will ever have in his career, I think. So I think the fight will happen. It would be a travesty for 2021 and boxing if that fight doesn't happen. Because as you know yourself, we've been around this long enough. Boxing, the blue ribbon division, lets everything else drip everywhere else and enhances the sport. You can get your Mikel, your Berchelts and your Valdez fights and your Teofimo Lopez and your Lomachenko fights, your Ramirez and your Josh Taylor fights. There's nothing as big for the sport because globally it attracts a massive interest. Even more so if it's in Saudi Arabia, because there'll be a political and sports washing
element to it all, a human rights side of it that people would be bringing. Amnesty will be quoted here, there, and everywhere. So the leading feature writers and the political writers will all get involved as well, because this is the biggest, richest. I mean, I've been covering boxing 30 years this year. This is the biggest, richest fight I've ever seen between two Britons. And arguably, it's the biggest heavyweight fight, I think, probably for 22 years since Lennox Lewis was undisputed champ. You know, so I know there have been some massive fights, but this is enormous in my view. I don't know if you agree with me on that.
I do. And look, this is an extremely complicated deal to finish. I think agreeing on the financial split was a huge hurdle crossed months back. But when you're dealing with as many television networks as you're dealing with, when you're dealing with as many people with their hands in the proverbial pie, whether it's Top Rank, Frank Warren, MTK, Eddie Hearn. I mean, really, it's more simplistic on Joshua's side. There are more people involved at this point with Tyson Fury, though MTK pretty much is the one steering the ship from that side of the aisle. All that being said, and maybe I'll live to regret these words, I'm very confident this deal gets
done. I agree.
I think they're too far down the road to have some of the smaller stuff screw it up. If they had not agreed on a financial split, I'd be saying no way.
Go back to Mayweather-Pacquiao. It happened in the end. Go back to McGregor and Mayweather. There is so much money at stake. And Eddie Hearn told me last December, nailed his colors to the mast. You know, I think I was the first person to get this out of Eddie. He thinks they will genuinely earn $120 million each, £100 million each. That's too big for it not to happen, because it doesn't.
And Gareth, if you're Tyson Fury, I don't know what your other option is. I mean, I guess you could find a way to rekindle the Wilder stuff, but the reason, and you know this, the reason the fight in December didn't happen was there was no money for it. Like, who was going to pay for Tyson Fury versus inferior opponent X when Fury wants to make and has been making a good amount of money? Like, it wasn't that they couldn't come up logistically with the way to make the fight happen. It was because with no crowd, you couldn't make the fight happen. You couldn't financially get to a place where Top Rank and Frank Warren, MTK, could afford to put that type of fight on. So this is it. Like, it's all in or go big or basically go home.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you look at the gate, I think it was $17 million from the gate for Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder 2.
It was.
Yeah, it was around that, wasn't it? Yeah. So once you get that gate, I remember when people like Floyd Mayweather, I think Floyd Mayweather ended up earning $43 million for fighting Miguel Cotto all those years ago. I remember talking to Burt Randolph Sugar at the time, a great mentor for both of us. May he rest in peace. Wonderful, wonderful character to be around on fight weeks. Once a fighter is at that level, they're not going to turn up for $5 million. And that's probably, or even $3 million. Maybe there was a limit with no crowd to what could take place. And I do think Tyson Fury is ruining. I mean, he's been fairly critical of his promoters. He's ruining the fact he didn't get a run out in December. That's a massive advantage for Anthony Joshua.
Huge.
And you know, there's all of us over here, and you've been over, and you know how good and how vibrant the British crowds are when they go to Wembley. You've been to Wembley. You were at Froch Groves too, weren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable when that stadium is full of 90,000, 80,000 people. It's almost unreal, isn't it? You know? And we all wanted that fight to be at Wembley Stadium with 90,000 people in it. But I think they will create a stadium in the Middle East somewhere. The site fees will be big enough from the money that's over there to be able to put on an event of this magnitude. And I do hope we get the second fight in Cardiff in the winter, because Wembley doesn't have a retractable roof, which Cardiff, the Millennium Stadium, has. And that can still seat 90,000. And I do think we'll get that. And hopefully we'll both be there for that. Hopefully the first fight is 12 rounds and bloody controversial, because then we'll have an even bigger fight when they meet again. Or it's a draw or whatever happens. But we just got to see the two guys fight, because, you know, the way that the seas have parted, and you've got a whole swathe of people who think Anthony Joshua has the power and the experience now to do it, and another load of people who think that Tyson Fury is just too good in the office for Anthony Joshua to basically pin Fury down and knock him out. Because for me, Joshua, when he goes for it in a fight, is still as good a finisher as Lennox Lewis was. He's one of the great finishers we've seen. And we often don't give Anthony Joshua enough credit for what he's done on the job. And I know that you have the argument, so we can have it now. I think Fury's resume is better because he was the first to beat Klitschko after that decade of his reign. And Joshua hasn't fought Deontay Wilder yet. And now it's a much more damaged Deontay Wilder. And I think his two performances against Wilder really put him up there as the number one in the division. I know you think Joshua is.
You could even say Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher.
He is.
If you wanted to say that about you, which is what I said right before Andrew Ruiz knocked him out. Let's save that, bottle that better resume conversation up for next time, when hopefully we're discussing a made fight between Fury and Joshua. We can talk about whether Fury's boxing skills or Joshua's power are going to be the biggest weapon in that fight. Gareth, always appreciate your time talking to you, man. Good stuff. We'll do it again.
Absolute pleasure to be on with you as always, my friend.
When we come back, my conversation with Clarissa Shields. All right, Clarissa Shields is the former undisputed middleweight champion, the former super middleweight champion, and on Friday, she will attempt to become undisputed in yet another weight class, this time junior middleweight. If successful, Clarissa will become the first boxer, male or female, to become undisputed in two weight divisions in the four-belt era. She takes on Marie Decaire. That is a fight on Friday, part of International Women's Day in Shields' hometown of Flint, Michigan. Clarissa, how are you today?
Good. You know, it's 4 days out from the fight, so I feel I'm anxious, but I'm just like super ready to just fight. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. How was making 154 pounds this time?
Easy. Mm-hmm. Easy.
Has it been easy throughout? I mean, you do kind of ping pong between 154, 160, 168.
So I fought at 54 my last fight. Mm-hmm. And I had a fight scheduled before then at 54. So it's probably been 154 in my last three fights. And I guess the first time it was probably a struggle, but the second and third time it wasn't. And making 160 is never hard. And 168 is my natural weight. So none of those are hard to make weight. Just, you know, it requires some discipline and stuff of that nature, but nothing that's too hard.
Is this a fight that excites you?
Yeah. I'm always excited to fight against another undefeated champion. I love fighting against girls who are from other countries too, because they always bring their whole country behind them. This is like USA versus Canada. She's undefeated. She's 17-0, and she's ranked number one at the 154 weight class. So that's also great, you know, because I love to challenge the number one girl. So this is great for me.
And you're getting a chance to fight on pay-per-view. The last time we spoke was over the summer, and you were pushing for that. You were hoping that somebody would get behind you and, you know, would, you know, you'd do a good number on pay-per-view. Tell me about the process here. It's not a pay-per-view with a Showtime or a traditional platform, but you are going on pay-per-view for the first time.
Yeah. Just, you know, I think everybody in the world was affected by the pandemic of COVID. And then the world started opening back up a little bit and boxing came back on. And I thought I would be one of the first people that Showtime would have back on, because I'm always in a gym, I'm always ready. And we already had my opponent picked and we already had our contracts and everything signed. But it just seemed like Showtime kept pushing our date back and back and back. And then before you knew it, I was supposed to fight September 26th. And if anybody recalls, that's the day when both Charlo brothers fought pay-per-view on Showtime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that didn't come to fruition. And then Showtime said, okay, no, not pay-per-view yet. But, you know, the next week on October 3rd, We want you to fight against Marie Eve Decaire. So I stay in the gym, I stay ready. And then finally, after the October 3rd thing didn't happen, they just told me and my team, like, hey, we can't get you in until 2021. And that was super just, you know, like that was super devastating to hear because I had been in the gym training. I had got my weight down. And then, you know, here that I wasn't fighting, my weight goes back up. Oh, and then it goes back down. And then to see that, you know, I was just getting put on a back burner for all the other fighters, which it was bothering me because no fighter that Showtime has accomplished more than me. And it just was like, you know, and I'm just saying, you know, Erickson Lubin, Terrell Boucher, David Benavidez, any top fighter you can name that's fought may have been on Showtime on a Saturday night has not accomplished more than me. And it was like, what else do I have to do to get a fight? And they were like, we're just waiting on them to give us a date. And that became frustrating to me. And I said, you know, a 3-time division world champion shouldn't have to do this.
Mm-hmm. So are you kind of betting on yourself here when it comes to getting paid?
Absolutely. And that's something that I can live with, you know? You know, people can say, oh, you're not, you know, worth this or you're not worth that. But when you have the numbers to prove what you are worth, nobody can take that away from you. Women haven't even been paid half of what I've been paid. And my highest purse was $350K. Take out all the people I had to pay, I probably got about $297, right? And women don't make that kind of money, right? So, but how come they don't make that kind of money? And it's because the networks tell them, oh, you're worth this much. And they just have to accept that number because we don't have any numbers to go off of and say, hey, we're worth this much because we did this many buys or we got this many views. We don't have nothing to rank our numbers off of so we can say what our worth is. Luckily for me, I fought on Showtime 6 times, main event, and I've been able to show them the numbers. Like me and Hannah Gabriels fought, we had 430K views. That's non-pay-per-view, but that's 430K views. A regular Showtime fight up on a Saturday night, David Benavidez, he's doing 188K. Adrian Barnes, he just came back. He did 288K. And everybody else who's fought, like the Erickson Lubin, Terrell Gachet, even Sean Porters, they're in the 150Ks, right? So when we talk about my worth on Showtime, I was worth a lot on Showtime. I just wasn't given an opportunity, you know, after COVID for whatever the reasons were. But we need to have our own numbers for the women. We need to be able to say, look, you can't pay us $20,000 if we have 100,000 people watching us. It's just not right. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is making money. And they got women getting paid $5,000 for a world championship fight. And that's not right. And we have to start building our own sport up so we can have something to say. Like, look, whatever these fair view numbers are, I'm going to get that check. And that'll be my check because that'll be what I'm worth at this time. That won't be what I'm worth forever. You know, that's just for right now. So whatever the numbers are, which I feel like they'll be pretty decent, we'll just work off that and build those numbers up because nobody talks about what was the men's first pay-per-view card numbers because whatever number it was, they built off of it. And that's how they got to the thousands and to the millions. Women's boxing haven't had a pay-per-view event since 2001. Layla Ali versus Jackie Ann Frazier. And that's Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier daughters. And that did 100,000K. But after that, nothing. Imagine if women's boxing would have kept having pay-per-view fights. Girls would have fought under Layla Ali in freaking Jackie Frazier. And you would have got the big fights on there. We would have a better gauge of what my numbers would be. But after not having it for 20 years, we have no idea. I just know that I have a large fan base in that my fans haven't seen me for 13 months. So I know everybody's going to be super excited for my return.
They definitely will be. And we've seen you training on Instagram and social media outlets, but it hasn't always been boxing training. Seen a lot of videos of you training for an MMA fight. on along those lines, like, how have you balanced boxing training with John David Jackson and the MMA training you're doing with Holly Holm and with others?
So, like I said, like, it was the pandemic, and I started training at Jackson Wing Gym in early December. So from December to early February, that's where I was training at, in Jackson Wing, and I was doing strictly MMA. It was some days where I would do boxing, but it was more of MMA because that's what I'm new to. And my first MMA fight will be in the middle of June. So I want to learn everything that I can before I have to go in there and have my first MMA fight. And how I balance it is, like, I'm not ever going to forget how to box. I've been boxing for 14 years. MMA is new. So it's like mixing the punches with the kicks, with the jiu-jitsu, with the wrestling. It's a whole different mind game. And I just wanted to get my mind used to having to go to that place of just like where everything goes, and you have to watch out not only for a one and a two, but for kicks to the head, kicks to the body, you know, elbows, knees, you know, you gotta look out for so many different things. And I just wanted to be aware of everything. So that's why I was doing MMA, but I stopped MMA training in February to focus strictly on this fight.
Mm-hmm. How did your MMA training go? You said you're going to fight in June. In MMA, do you feel ready for it?
Yeah, I feel ready, and I'm happy that I'm having this fight in early March because I have so much more time to train, you know, and to get ready. And that's the thing. I've always lived by the five P's. Proper preparation prevents poor performance. And I'm just going to get ready. And I know that I'll be able to sleep good at night as long as I know that I gave 100%, right? That I did the training, that I did the workouts. And I'm going to be in Jackson Wink 2 weeks after my fight, and I'll be down there till my fight in June. So I'm going to give it the time that is needed. I respect the sport, and I respect the disciplines. And people are going to see a way meaner Clarissa Shields inside the cage because it's just more stuff that you can do.
Are you comfortable with the grappling aspect of MMA? I mean, it's combat sports, but as you clearly know, it's two different sports.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. If I wasn't, I wouldn't be doing it. But that's where, like, the training comes in place. When I first went to Jackson Wing Gym, I was walking to the cage, and I thought to myself, and I said, Jesus, what am I doing here? But I said it out loud, and one of the coaches looked at me, and he said, Clarissa is going to be okay. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, you just said, Jesus, what are you doing here? And I'm like, wow, I'm out of my mind. You know, I'm just, you know, and the coaches asked me, they said, what are you most worried about? And I said, I'm not worried about standing up combat, you know, as far as in the punching and the kicking. I'm like, that's the least I'm worried about. I said, I'm just worried about the ground game. And that's the first thing we start working on. And we drilled it and we drilled it and we drilled it. And now when I come to the gym and he says, you know, get on your back, we're going to fight off our backs today, I'm not uncomfortable. But when I first did it, when he first said, get on your back, I was like, oh my God, no, I didn't want to do it. But it was just about getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I've gotten comfortable with that. So I practiced jiu-jitsu, wrestling, kickboxing, and of course boxing. And it's all about mixing it all together to be the fighter that I feel comfortable being. So I feel comfortable knowing that I have a bunch of different offenses that I know and a lot of different defenses that I know for people not to do things to me. So I've been learning. I've been learning everything pretty fast. And the coaches at Jackson Wink, Holly Holm and Johnny Bones, are super impressed with me. So I think I'm doing a great job.
So is the plan for you, at least for now, to kind of ping pong between the two sports? How do you approach it?
Yeah. So right now we're looking at this fight in March. I have an MMA match in June. Then I want to fight again in boxing in September. And then I want to have another MMA match by December. So it's going back and forth. And the reason I'm able to do all that is because I'm 25 years old. And I really just love fighting. I love combat sports. And I feel like it's just a bigger cause. You know, me being great in MMA builds my resume in boxing, strangely. Like, it makes me bigger, right? It makes me more known. And even though it shouldn't, but it does. And at the same time, that doesn't bother me. I just have to do what I have to do.
So you're going to try to become the second two-division undisputed world champion, or to get the second time for you. Nobody's done it, men or women. Evander Holyfield did it with three belts back in the 1990s. Have you spoken to Evander about that accomplishment?
Yeah, I had asked Evander. I said, you know, you're the last boxer to be undisputed in two different weight classes, that cruiserweight and heavyweight. And he said, yeah. And I'm like, well, I'm about to do it in the four-belt era, so I'll be the first person to do it in the four-belt era. And I said, what's the secret? And he said, the secret is to never stoop down to your opponent's level. He said, no matter what they say. He said, people said that he was too small to go to heavyweight. People said he won't have any punching power at heavyweight and that his speed won't do him no good at heavyweight. And he took that and he used everything that he had to become champion up at heavyweight. So he said, don't stoop down to people's level and, you know, take away from yourself. He said, he told me that I'm cursed with skills. That's what he said. And he said, people are going to try to get me to go out there and just be a banger and slug it out. He said, never abandon my skills and never stoop down to my opponent's level. If I go out there and I outpoint a girl 10 rounds, he said, to be proud of that and to build off of that performance. But he said, don't go out there trying to punch hard and knock a girl out and you go out there and you look wild and you don't perform what you want to perform. He said, stick to what makes you great. And that was the best advice that I've got in this camp.
Did you find that interesting coming from Evander, who was involved in some serious wars in his fighting career?
No, I didn't. But I mean, he always fought his style though. You know, people, I mean, he was just saying like, you know, people was telling him that it was more of speed that he needed for the heavyweights. And he wanted to let people know he had power too. So he was like, he stuck to what he knew, not to what everybody thought that he should have been doing. Because could you imagine Evander Holyfield going out there and moving up from cruiserweight to heavyweight and trying to bounce around like Muhammad Ali? It's like, no, Evander Holyfield was standing there in the pocket with you, catch your punches on his shoulder, and he light you up. And he was standing there and he got in the wars, but he won a lot of wars too.
One thing about the pay-per-view I wanted to ask you, you're obviously doing a lot of media for it. We'll do a lot of media for it during the fight week. Has there been a temptation on your part to try to find some controversy with you and Marie? You know, something, some bad blood type of stuff?
No. No.
No shove at the weigh-in coming or something like that? Some Bernard Hopkins move?
I'm not going to shove her. not me. No. Honestly, I think that my team is doing a great job with just the promotion. I think all my celebrity friends have been sharing the poster and sharing it for me. And the word is out, you know, and I just feel like it's going to do great. But I think, you know, the best controversy is just the natural controversy, stuff that just happens. You don't know what's going to happen. So I'm not thinking of, what can I do to get people to pay attention? It's like, I think the people who are paying attention are paying attention and that'd be it. But I'm not going to stir up nothing. I mean, but I always talk trash to all my opponents and I've talked trash to Marie DeCare. She barely responds to it, but I mean, that's just me. I'm just a natural trash talker and a natural trash backer upper. You know, whatever I say that I'm going to do, nine times out of 10, I do it.
So you're going for Undisputed 154, and you're going to be in and out of boxing over the next year. On March 13th, the 147-pound Undisputed Championship is on the line, the rematch between Jessica McCaskill and Cecilia Brækus. How interested are you in the outcome of that fight?
I'm interested 1 through 100, I'll say about 60%. And only reason being is because I know Cecilia Brækus won't fight me because we already traveled down that venture. And I don't know if Jessica McCaskill will fight me either. Like, I mean, it's great for them to be fighting for the Undisputed Championship and to be rematching each other. That's great for them. But when I think about me, I want to fight them, right? And if they're gonna be too scared to fight me, I don't think I should even entertain either of them. But Jessica said something about she reached out to my team about a fight with me or something. Even though she lied, I would love for her to do that. And I don't know. I just think that if I want to become a four-time division world champ, that I would explore my options if at 147, but it would have to be against the girls who are number one. And I don't really care about, not that the girls at number two aren't good or anything, but it's not really something that I really, I like to fight the best. And the best is always number one. You know, if I have to fight number two to get to number one, I will. But if I can go straight to number one and fight the best, that'd be great for me too. But I don't know. I don't think that the 147 division want to see any of me though. What do you think?
I think the first thing they would say would there have to be a rehydration clause is what Jessica McCaskill's team would say. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I wouldn't rehydrate up past 157. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But well, that's the thing. I don't even rehydrate up that many pounds when I fight at 154. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's just like, I feel like I could care less about what a girl rehydrates up to after we weigh in. That doesn't matter to me. I mean, when I fought against Cindy LeBlanc, we were weighing up at 168. She came in the next day weighing 185. I was 172. Mm-hmm. So I still went in there and worked her and did my job, you know, but I just feel like if we're fighters, you shouldn't be worried about somebody else's weight. But I understand that, you know, weight matters and stuff like that. But when you're as great as I am, weight doesn't matter. That's why I can go to 147 and damn near drain myself and still whoop those girls.
I think it would be like, just it's more speculation, but I think it would be a fight that a lot of people would be interested in. And I think money would talk in that situation. I think there would be some network interest, whether it's from Eddie Hearn or somebody else, to get you in for the undisputed welterweight championship, which, you know, could then open a door, perhaps, if you win that title, for Katie Taylor to move up and fight you for the undisputed welterweight championship.
I mean, but wasn't that the plan for Katie to fight against the winner of Jessica McCaskill and Cecilia Brakus?
Well, I mean, yes, if it was Brakus, and Brakus had the rematch clause, so it kind of, you know, that went the way it went.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I think that the dream fight overall is for me and Katie Taylor to fight. But like, mm-hmm, I said 60%, because going down to 147-1, it is a kind of a push for me, but the numbers got to make sense and everything else got to make sense. The rehydration clause, all that stuff, it got to make sense. But I think that the dream fight to make is me and Katie at 147. If she was going to come to 147 to fight against Cecilia or Jessica. She's already beat Jessica. And I don't think that Cecilia would give her any kind of problems. But yeah, I think the best fight to make up at 147 will be me and Katie, if she was interested. I don't want people thinking like, oh, you're calling out Katie Taylor. It's like a little bit, but not really. It's like if she's going to come to 147 and, mm-hmm, fight against those girls, don't exclude me. Just like I said before. Don't exclude me, because if I make 147, the same rules should apply to me that apply to the other girls.
You versus Katie Taylor would be like, you could call it the GOAT fight for the greatest woman of all time title. Like, you would. You really. Like, you could make, like, both you guys, you have the two gold medals, of course, but Katie, a decorated Olympian as well. That would be the greatest woman of all time fight. You both in your prime,
and
so to speak.
And it would. And I'd be honored to share the ring with her. I think back in like 2016, Ireland was sparring against the U.S., right? And they were just doing sparring. I was like, coach, let me spar again. Let me spar with Katie. And he was like, hell no. And this was Coach Billy. He's from Ireland. I'm like, y'all act like I'm going to go on there and just try to knock. Like, I wanted to see, like, when you see somebody's skills through like a TV screen or you see them fight in person, you think to yourself, you know, me anyway, what would I have to do to beat them? Or like, how would it be like in a fight with us? When I seen her fighting, I just was like, dang, I wonder what it would be like, you know, one, if I was smaller, or two, if she was bigger and, you know, she possessed some skills. I just wanted to spar with her though, but her team said no. And Coach Billy was saying no. And I'm like, I just want to get in there. And like, really at the time, she was, a five-time world champ, you know, back in the amateurs, which I'm like, shit, she's accomplished more than any boxer in the amateur history. You know, like I would love to get in there with her. And I think I was going, I was a two-time world champion, then I had turned professional. But I just was like, damn, you know, we could have gotten there and moved around a little bit. I wasn't going to do it. I mean, I was going to use my speed and stuff, but I really want to know like who's faster. Even though she's smaller, I wonder who punches faster.
I tell you, one would think that if she moved up to 147 and you moved down to fight, that she might move a lot in a fight like that. Katie's a really soft-spoken person, but as you know, when you see her in the ring, she wants to trade. Like, she gets in there and roughs it up. So I think, you know, style-wise, that could be a really fun fight too.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, she's had fights where girls just come forward and she can adjust her game plan to where she can move. But we've yet to see Katie Taylor enter with a girl who possesses my kind of skills and also comes forward to where, like, now you got to move and you got to punch and you got to be defensive. Like, you got to do, you got to do a whole lot, you know? So it'd be a very interesting fight. And I would love to see what Katie has to say about it. She know I love her. I reached out to her after all her fights. But also, too, if it ever comes down to it, the greatest woman has to be decided in the ring. And if she's ever up for a fight at 147 with me, tell her I would not turn her down.
I like it. I like it. First up for you, Marie Decaire, that is a fight on Friday. That's why you can see on Friday on pay-per-view, fight.tv, or your pay-per-view provider in Claressa's hometown of Flint, Michigan. Claressa, good luck with the fight, with the pay-per-view, with everything. I hope it all works out.
Yep, it will. And I got something to say on here. You said that I was the former undisputed champion up at 160. Savannah Marshall fought for my Vanky belt. I never lost that belt. So in my book, I'm still undisputed up at 160, and I'm going to whoop Savannah Marshall first chance I get.
That's another good fight. So there are some good fights out there for you this year.
Hey, I'm all over. I'm not ducking no action. Like, after this fight, if Cecilia and Jessica want to scrap, I'll go to 47. If Savannah, you know, got her life together and she want to get up, I'll go to 160. It doesn't matter. I'm not ducking no smoke, but they all know, come with the check.
No question about it. No question. Claressa, good luck. We'll talk to you soon. All right, that's it for this week's episode. My thanks to my guests. As always, subscribe to the podcast over at Apple Podcasts. Rate, review. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.